As we remain standing, I want to read most of our passage this morning from Ecclesiastes. It's not strictly speaking law, nothing really for you to do, but it is showing the vanity of life this side of the fall. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under heaven, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this is also but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, and my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. Behold, all was vanity, a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned and I considered wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I perceived that the same event happens to them all. I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? Said in my heart that this is also vanity. For of this wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to the despair above all the toil and the labor under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what is a man from all the toil and striving of his heart, which he has toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. No. All right, you may be seated for the gospel. We just sang about the King Supreme of the universe, and these are still the words of his little king in Jerusalem. Just the ending of our text, and then one short passage in Mark. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. And in Mark's gospel, about the Lord Jesus, and as he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, and there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to the disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but the sinners." Father, we thank you for your word and your gospel and for Ecclesiastes and for the work of Christ coming here to eat and drink and to call those who need a physician. We pray that you would help us to see more of his glory today and the things that we do throughout our worship service and what we sing and what we participate in with the sacraments and the word that is preached and as we pray and all the things that we do. We ask that you would glorify yourself and bring us closer to yourself, especially through Christ and by your Holy Spirit, we ask in his name. Well, we have a lot going on in the worship service this morning, and we wanted to have both the baptism and the Lord's Supper at the same time. And so a little bit shorter prayer. We're going to go here to our passage that we've read for the law and the gospel. We're going to talk here at the beginning about the meaning of life. So man has been on a quest for the meaning of life basically since the very beginning. And there are many people who think that they know it. And as I was thinking through this and trying to find an introduction, I was surprised to find that there was a very long Wikipedia article called The Meaning of Life. It's fairly exhaustive, and it takes us through scientific and philosophical and psychological and religious perspectives, all that try to ground the question. And then there have been many specific examples of people who have tried to sum it up as well. So I'm going to give you a few of those here at the beginning. Plato believed that the meaning of life was to attain the highest form of knowledge, the idea form of the good, from which all good and just things derive. Now, Aristotle was his little rebellious pupil, and he disagreed, and he said that seeking the highest good for its own sake is the meaning of life, and that this is the equivalent, he said, of happiness, well-being, flourishing, and excellence, which reminded me of Thomas Jefferson, which he might have had this in mind when he said, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When he said that, he was not being a hedonist. I think he was being more Aristotelian. But I want to talk about hedonism as their meaning of life. A hedonist is somebody who pursues bodily gratification and intense physical pleasure as the meaning and purpose of life. And in the comic strip, Calvin once told Hobbes something along these lines. He said, "Everybody seeks happiness, but not me. That's the difference between me and the rest of the world. Happiness isn't good enough for me. I demand euphoria." This is a very selfish view of the purpose of life. Some forms of transhumanism are hedonistic because for them, the meaning of life is to achieve biological perfection and live as long as possible. This is often said as an individual pursuit, but I don't see any way that you could do that without it being corporately implemented. There's another corporate equivalent, which is called utilitarianism, that says that whatever brings the greatest happiness to the greatest number of people is the meaning of life. You have a total other end of the spectrum. You have nihilism. Nihilists are incredibly pessimistic, believing that life is simply absurd and that seeking meaning from this world is ridiculous because there is none to be had. And you think about that, what Douglas Adams wrote in his Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where after a 7.5 million year calculation by the giant supercomputer called Deep Thought, it finally revealed that the meaning of life is 42. That's nihilism. Ironically, nihilists end up seeking pleasure just about as much as hedonists do, as you can tell by their private lives. Monty Python had an entire movie called The Meaning of Life, and in it, the main character carries around an envelope that contains the answer to the meaning of life. It's finally revealed, and on the inside it says, "Well, it's nothing very special. Just try to be nice to people, avoid eating fat, read a good book every now and then, get some walking in, try to live together in peace and harmony with people of all creeds and nations." And that was it. Then, of course, there's religion. Hinduism teaches that the meaning of life is to realize the fundamental truth about yourself. Buddhism says it's to embrace suffering and well-being in this life. Some Jews believe the meaning of life is to elevate the physical world and prepare it for the world to come, which is the Messianic era. Mormons say we are to gain knowledge and experience and have joy. Islam says it's to worship Allah and be grateful to Him through love and devotion. And the Westminster Confession, or Catechism, teaches that it's to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. That's a lot of different ideas of the meaning of life. And beginning in Ecclesiastes 1:12, the preacher sets his sight on answering this age-old riddle. Now, there's a lot going on in this passage because I've chosen a rather large chunk to do at once. Now, many people break this up into smaller units, but properly speaking, you go from verse 12 of chapter 1 to the chapter 3, verse 1, which is a single unit of thought in the Hebrew text. And so many commentaries actually do deal with this unit all at once, although usually most save 3:1 for the discussion of next time. Now, the passage opens similarly to the book. Verse 12 has the preacher identifying himself again as the king over Israel in Jerusalem. And as such, those who deal with these verses together have summarized them as the royal experiment or the king's experiment. And what's he experimenting on? Someone has called them reflections on the vanities of life. Another has called it his search for answers. But it isn't just reflections and answers in general. Rather, it's the teacher's search for meaning, as someone said. Or another one said, wisdom's failure to discover life's meaning, giving away what our passage is going to say. Sidney Grandius rightly concludes, therefore, that this is an ideal passage for exploring the contemporary concern for the meaning of life. Now, the entire section is autobiographical. It takes us through a series of historical quests. These quests are marked by phrases like, I applied my heart to seek and to search, or I applied my heart to know, or I said in my heart, come now. And he keeps going with those kinds of ideas. So I divide these quests this way. First, you have the quest using wisdom to find out all that's done under heaven. Then he turns to test pleasure. And then he tests wisdom and folly. And all of this leads to a very negative conclusion about life, which then becomes the central unit of thought in the passage, where he says, like he did at the very beginning of the book, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. And then those three quests lead to a series of inverse parallel reflections. They begin with a negative reflection about toil that reflects the negative assessment of life. This turns into a series of reverse reflections on the three quests together. He reflects on wisdom and folly. He reflects on pleasure. He gives some advice about it, and then he reflects on life. So the very center of our passage is chapter 2, verse 17, this idea of vanity, as we're making our way through it. Now, if you set out on a quest for the meaning of life, I would think that you're going to set your sights as high as you can. You really want to know the answer to this. And that's what the preacher does, starting in verse 13. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Ryken summarizes this. He says he wanted to understand life, not just one part of life, but life taken as a whole. His quest was an extensive and intensive quest. The preacher was an ancient style Renaissance man. He wanted to know as much as he could about as many things as he could. He wanted to take it all in. He wanted to leave nothing out so that his conclusions would be as definitive as possible. So he's going for it. He's going to try and answer the question. Now, those who really want to do this, do it with all of their being, like the preacher. New American Standard translates the word heart there as mind. This refers to the inner man, the core of who you are. The mind, in our idea, reflects intelligence, right? Heart conveys emotions and passions, and the will conveys determination and resolve. And all of these are encapsulated by this word. But even given sincerity, this task would be very difficult to carry out if he were not a king. But as a king, he has many resources at his disposal. The most important of these that he mentions is something that most world leaders have never had an iota of, which is wisdom. This word is epitomized by no one in the Old Testament better than King Solomon. When Solomon had been newly ordained as king, God appeared to him almost like a genie and said, ask what I shall give you. And Solomon asked only one thing. He said, give me wisdom. And he said he wanted wisdom and knowledge to learn how to govern the vast number of Israelites that were under his authority. So here's the question of the day. What is wisdom? Ryken says that wisdom in Ecclesiastes is what human beings can learn about the world without any special revelation from God. Now, I feel the force of this, because his searching out the meaning of life is for the most part taken up with very secular and mundane pursuits. Nevertheless, I think there is more going on here. Prior to this story found in Kings and Chronicles, where he's asked what he wants and he says wisdom, the word only appears less than a handful of times. In Deuteronomy 4:6, wisdom is keeping God's law. In Deuteronomy 34:9, it's the quality given to Joshua to rule the people after Moses. And in 2 Samuel 14, we find its first association with Christ. It says, "But my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all things that are on the earth." Now you can hear in these things how closely they are identified with King Solomon. In Proverbs, wisdom is the wise woman who hearkens to a son to listen to heed her voice. And so in that way, I think wisdom is a step beyond knowledge. It's knowing how to apply knowledge to your life. But I think it's even more than this. It's summarized best in verses like Proverbs 9:10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Now, it can seem like the preacher doesn't really fear God at all in this book, because there are a lot of sins that he engages in, even in our own section. Nevertheless, he clearly has God in mind in its very first use in Ecclesiastes. This is verse 13. He says, "I applied my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under the sun." It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And indeed, as he saw how unhappy all this toil actually is, whether he's sin or not, it was his driving wisdom that brought him to the end of the book, where he says that fearing God is the conclusion of the matter. So I don't think the preacher is merely making use of secular wisdom like Plato or Nietzsche might. Plato could do none of this. Wisdom is a quality that both knows and fears the Creator God, including God the Father, whom a son makes glad by loving wisdom. God the Son, who is wisdom incarnate. And God the Holy Spirit, who is the Spirit of wisdom. And so this makes it ironic that so many non-Christians love Ecclesiastes, because in not knowing and trusting God, they actually miss the most fundamental point of the book. If you want to truly understand the meaning of life, it is impossible to do so without wisdom. And biblically speaking, you cannot have wisdom unless you know and fear God through His Son. So I encourage you to call out to him and learn what wisdom is. Because we live in a foolish and dark age, and without wisdom, you're going to be lost. And in fact, without wisdom, you're going to be lost in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, our age is in this respect identical to all others. As we just saw, the preacher continues, it's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So what is the business? Searching out the meaning of life by looking into all that is done under heaven. That's the business. So why is it unhappy to search for the meaning of life? He says, "I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind." So that's how the preacher begins his sermon. He doesn't want us to forget that seeking out the meaning of life is like trying to chase after the wind. Chasing after the wind would make anyone unhappy, because it's impossible to ever catch it. And yet unhappy is a rather odd translation for the word ra in Hebrew, which usually means evil. And hence the Septuagint has an evil trouble, or an evil or disastrous business. That's what we're engaging in here. Verse 15, his gloom turns more specific. He says, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." And this refers to all kinds of things. It can refer to moral evil, or natural disasters, or just regular old life that gets mixed up and crooked and bent because of conflicts and mistakes and moral failings and financial trouble and physical disability, and on you could go. Everyone has something, probably many things that they wish that could be straightened out. The preacher says life is full of things that can't be. There's so many things like this that they can't be counted. Get used to it, he says. This certainly qualifies, I think, as an evil trouble, trying to figure out the meaning of life. The preacher's investigations into the four corners of the world, going to the farthest recesses of various cultures, plumbing the deepest minds of knowledge, were all guided by wisdom. He said, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Now, no one has ever had more, as the many extra-biblical stories about Solomon's esoteric and almost Babylonian quest for knowledge teaches us, but that's for another sermon. He wanted to learn the difference between wisdom and folly in verse 17. I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. He wanted to know what makes a fool tick. What causes a person to go insane? Why do so many people do so many stupid things? What is the meaning of all this? And as he looked into this, he says, I perceive that this is also but a striving after wind. And with such striving, he learned, for in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases grief. Or as the NIV puts it, the more knowledge, the more grief. The more you know, the more you begin to realize you wish you didn't know it. Am I right? Yep. It has become increasingly popular in the last couple of years for people to want to know what's actually going on in this world. Conspiracies that have been bantered around for decades and generations are now making their way to the surface of the popular imagination. Many of those conspiracies are treated by those who perpetrate them as conspiracy theories, which has become a kind of four-letter word. They do this to hide and mask their crimes. Nevertheless, it's a powerful trope that anyone engaging in those must be a mad fool. And so we're right there at folly. And yet these theories persist and they grow. And when you take a deep dive into the very worst of them, you quickly begin to realize that there is an evil out there that is so much darker and sinister and powerful than you ever possibly imagined, that you often wish you didn't know it. What can you possibly do in the face of those? Better to live in ignorant bliss than with the grief that accompanies this knowledge. And yet the temptation is to want to know others to know it with you. That's a chasing after the wind. It isn't that such knowledge is unhelpful in any respect. It can be, primarily if it's used to help people, but it can also be a tremendous burden. And worse, if it's only being pursued for its own sake, like some kind of a mind game, if it's what you do with all your time, then you can have this become your meaning of life. This is a lot like Plato seeking to find the highest knowledge, which is in some ways a close handmaiden to this topic, because both are dealing with rather underground subjects. Basically, what Solomon is saying about his quest is that to try and attain knowledge for knowledge's sake is a dead end, no matter what kind it is. That which Greeks wanted to make the meaning of life isn't the meaning of life. This was not able to help the preacher come to any conclusion on this question. Rather, all it did was increase his frustration and generate vexation and sorrow. So he gives up the pursuit of knowledge, and he turns to pleasure. It's interesting how these mirror the popular answers to the question that are still around today: knowledge and pleasure. We saw earlier how so many people think that pleasure is the meaning of life. Ecclesiastes 2:1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Now we are in a culture that has taken this quest to the absolute farthest possible place. It is literally all the West now does. Recreation, sports, games, entertainment, theater, movies, TV, sex, drugs, rock and roll, escapism from reality. Bono and Johnny Cash explore this in a song called The Wanderer. which Bono said was inspired by Ecclesiastes. He says, in its lyrics, the man ventures out into the world that's part of apocalyptic, it's part apocalyptic and part consumerist. The cities are soulless capitals of tin with streets of gold. The sky above them is atomic. And the protagonist, the wanderer, goes out in search of experience, hoping to taste everything a man can before he repents, is the line. Now, I don't think that we're just experimenting like the preacher did, who was testing this to see what it would produce. We're in full-blown addiction mode. And many don't care a whit to even think about repenting. Not yet, at least. And I pray that God will make them come to that end soon enough. But what has this gotten us, this seeking of pleasure in our culture? The same thing he summarizes before he goes into the details. Behold, this is also vanity. So he sets his sights on specific kinds of pleasure. Verse 2, I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? Now, by mad, he's not saying that people who laugh are insane, okay? Some think he's talking about a kind of laughter that jokes at other people's expense. It's more probable that this kind of laughter is the laughter a fool engages in, sometimes at other people's expense, and sometimes to mask their own grief and sorrow. Trumper Longman says, Proverbs frequently pictures fools laughing on the road to destruction. Nevertheless, the wise, and even Lady Wisdom herself, laugh. The difference between the fool and the wise person in Proverbs is the timing of their laughter and its object. While Kohelet recognizes that there is an appropriate time for laughter later, he also notes that the wise person cannot discern the times. So here in verse 2, as well as later, he denigrates laughter. Now he turns from laughter to alcohol, testing it with wisdom. He says, I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Now many people drink completely apart from wisdom. They're hiding some pain they don't want to deal with. They simply want to feel good. The preacher sets his mind to understand what the fool does with wine, but guided by wisdom. His conclusion will come after a series of other pleasures that he searches out. He goes on by taking us on a virtual tour of his life. The focus is on things he made in verses 4 and 6, things he bought in verse 7, things he gathered in verse 8. They're summarized in verse 10 by his work or his toil. These include great works projects, houses, vineyards, gardens, parks, many fruit trees, pools, generations of male and female slaves, great possessions of flocks and herds, massive amounts of silver and gold, singers, both men and women, and many concubines, he says, and presumably as many other things as he could think of. And he concludes and says, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Now, this is a biographical outline of our author, of material possessions, and it's probably the single best reason why people believe Solomon wrote this book. This is just a bit of what Solomon accumulated in his life according to Chronicles and Kings. Solomon had more chariots, horsemen, and ships than he knew what to do with. He had one fleet alone that would be gone for 3 years and traveled to the most exotic places in the world, bringing back much gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. We're told that he made silver and gold, quote, as common as stone. He had 700 wives and 300 porcupines. As a kid, I actually wrote that on a test one time in a book I read. 300 concubines. He spent 13 years building his own palace, which was full of gardens and parks and trees and herds and flocks of animals. Compare that to the mere 7 years it took him to build the first temple to God. He had singers and servants, so many that the Queen of Sheba was astonished. Solomon had so much wine available that he gave 120,000 gallons a day to Hiram, king of Tyre, and his woodsmen who were cutting the timber for the temple. Indeed, this was a man who had it all, and no one before him or since has had anything close to him in all of Israel's history. Indeed, the world's richest people today do not compare. As adjusted for inflation, some have estimated that his 25 tons of gold amassed each year would be worth over $2 trillion in today's money. Now, I've always been amazed at the statement in verse 9, "Also my wisdom remained with me." Am I alone in this? How could a man engage in all these activities, many of them which are quite sinful, and yet say he was guided by wisdom? Is there really a fear of God here? Well, so I think the answer is a bit of a paradox. Because it isn't wisdom that's causing him to sin, yet it's the pursuit of all these pleasures, some even sinful, using wisdom that will allow him to come to the conclusion he does at the end of our passage, as well as the overall conclusion at the end of the book. Had he not been guided by wisdom, he never could have reached these conclusions. Rather, he would have been taken down by the pursuit itself, a thing which, even guided by wisdom, almost did bring Solomon to his own end. But the preacher, probably Solomon, at the end of his life, after God had pronounced a curse on Israel because of his many disobediences, says in verse 11, "Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there's nothing to be gained under the sun." Pleasure, all the pleasure in the entire world, pleasures that only a very few on this earth can ever hope to see, gained him nothing. In other words, this isn't the meaning of life. And so many people pursue the same things, and they often come to realize the same truth. What did all this do to profit me? So having pursued knowledge and pleasure, now he turns to the ideas he first mentioned earlier. A different topic. This is a specific quest of wisdom and folly in verse 12. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can a man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. So the key literary feature is when it says, "What can the man do who comes after the king?" This returns in verse 18 when he says, "I must leave it to the man who will come after me." Preacher recognizes that he's been pursuing foolish things. He even said so earlier, but pursuing these foolish things through wisdom, which is an irony if there ever was one, allows him to conclude, "Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly." But why would he say that? Folly gave him pleasure. Wisdom gave him grief. And yet he says this. How can this be? It's because the poetic parallel of the second half of the verse, "Wisdom is like light, folly is like darkness, as there is more gain in light than in darkness," he says. And again, the wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. You can become drunk as a skunk or as high as a kite, and what good does it do you if you can't see the door to the bathroom to go throw up? And so you hit your head on the wall and knock yourself out in the pursuit. Those in the dark can't see where they're going. Wisdom lets you see where you're going. Now, this sounds like the preacher is now finally ready to tell you the meaning of life. It sounds like he's going to say that pursuing wisdom is the meaning of life. But he doesn't do that. In fact, in his next words, they're like a cup of coffee spilled on your lap while you're driving to work. He says, "And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this is also vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have to be forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool." So he says, "I'm going to die. They're going to die. They won't be remembered. I won't be remembered. Everything is going to be forgotten. Everyone dies. It's wisdom that's allowing him to see all this." It's also ironic because we're remembering everything he did because he wrote the book. The moment he realized this, he says, so I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. I want you to notice, beginning of verse 18, says almost the same thing. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun. Now, these are some of the reasons so many people think that Ecclesiastes is just a depressing book of nihilism. But the frame of these two verses is doing something. It's pointing two large arrows at the middle, which is the way he began the book. He says, for all is vanity and is striving after wind. And the point is, he has searched for the meaning of life, and the second he thought he saw it, it vanished. And the moment he thought he understood it, he forgot it. The instant he thought he knew it, it turned like a knife in his gut. His quest did not lead him to the answer. Instead, it left him empty. So coming away empty-handed, the preacher begins to reflect on these quests. He goes in reverse order. First, he thinks about the one who will come after him and whether that king will be wise or a fool. Verses 18 and 19. Why did he hate his toil? He says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be the master for all which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This is vanity. Now, if you read Kings or Chronicles, you know that the life of Rehoboam, who Solomon's son and his successor, epitomizes the preacher's fears. Having taken the throne after his father, he was immediately confronted by Jeroboam, who had been exiled by Solomon. Jeroboam and the people wanted to know if the son of Solomon would go easier on the people than his father. He was given some very good advice by the old wise men to go easier on them, and they will listen and they will follow you. But Rehoboam listened instead to the counsel of the young princes, who told him to make life even worse for the rebels. And for his arrogant aggrandizing and obscene taunting, Jeroboam took 10 tribes with him and split the kingdom, which would never be restored again. Rehoboam indeed became the inheritor of all Solomon's glory, but he was a fool's fool and ended up being the seed of destruction of the entire empire. The preacher continues, so I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This is also vanity and great evil. So if you assume Solomon is our preacher, it's almost as if he knew that his son was a fool. And he saw the writing on the wall of both his own death and Rehoboam soon rise to king, and he was deeply grieved by all he had done because he knew it would be squandered and very soon forgotten. And indeed, in many respects, it took less than a generation for this to happen. In fact, it began almost immediately. At breakneck speed in just his fifth year of rule, after 40-plus years of total peace under Solomon, Shishak, king of Egypt, came against Jerusalem and took away the treasures of the house of the Lord, the king. And it says, he took away everything. Ecclesiastes is right. It is vanity, chasing after the wind. Now the preacher next begins to reflect on his toil and all the pleasures that he sought. First, he considers all his work, all the things he accumulated and gathered around himself. He says, what has a man from all the toil and striving a heart for which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. And the main thing he adds here is that he couldn't sleep at night. His work was so all-consuming that rest escaped him. How many people work this same way? They can't enjoy anything they're working for. They think about work all the time. It's a heavy burden that they wish that they could get out from under. Many people like Solomon work to gain more and more and more. The monster's never satiated. And thus they are constantly scheming and dreaming up ways to get richer and buy more stuff, and they can't sleep. Many, unlike Solomon, have to work just so they can eat. They don't get any rest for very different reasons. Too worried about paying the bills the next day. They wish they had another job. Both of these are a terrible burden and certainly not the meaning of life. Now it's just here, what feels like is going to be a never-ending downer of never learning the meaning of life that we have a reversal. What he says seems to be the point, a point that might just allow for him to rest after all. He turns to consider how pleasure was a main goal of his toil. And it is here in verses 24 and 25 and then 26 that we finally, I think, get some kind of an answer. Now, I'm not going to say this is the meaning of life. That really doesn't come until chapter 12, if it comes at all. However, what he says takes us to the first of seven texts on joy in the book. The fourth of these is the very center of the book, as I told you a week or two ago. This is the first, and it centers on eating and drinking, which parallels the enjoyment of wine in verses 1 through 3. There's nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. And that's the reason why I wanted to read to you Jesus eating and drinking with sinners and tax collectors. He understood what was going on here. Indeed, the enjoyment of life is one of its chief meanings. When you work, enjoy the fruit of your labor. If you work with your hands, take pleasure in it, in how it produces the very basic necessities of life, things that are in and of themselves very pleasurable. And since work will never be completed, take time and rest. Now, just hear that the preacher takes this a step further, because he's no atheist or agnostic, and this is not a mere hedonistic meaning of life. Rest has to have a spiritual purpose, like we find with the Lord's Day. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God, he says. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? And so we have this ironic reversal. The first time God ever came up in Ecclesiastes was back in verse 13 of chapter 1. He says, it's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. But the second time he appears is in our verse here. To enjoy this unhappy business is also from God. Indeed, this is from his hand. That's a personification of his direct involvement in your life. If you contemplate the meaninglessness of life after you're gone, and if you think long and too often about work, and if you're looking only to pleasure to get you through all of this life, then stop. Enjoy what God has given you, whether it's a lot or a little. None of it will profit you eternally. Only trust in God himself can do that. But the bonus is, he will also allow you to enjoy the very things that are so exasperating and absurd and temporary about this life right now. And how many people never ever find this kind of enjoyment? How many Christians? Far too many. But in Christ, it's possible. And we come to a concluding verse that returns us to knowledge. It also continues the theme of pleasure. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after wind. Now, this almost would have been a wholly positive ending to my sermon were it not for this ending of this. This ending, which takes us back to vanity and striving after wind, is one of the seven breath evaluations in chapter 2. And seven's the perfect number, and so this seventh reinforces the overall thesis of the book. But you don't want to miss the positive point that's being made here, because they feel so few and far between sometimes in Ecclesiastes. True wisdom is a gift from God. That wisdom can lead to much knowledge, as vexing and wearisome as it can be. But the third component, which is also God's gift, is joy. He mentions the sinner who is contrasted with the one who pleases God, God who has given. Okay? Here the sinner is the person who refuses to enjoy God's gifts. Yes, it's a sin not to be joyful in the face of such burdens. Rejoice in the Lord. How often does Paul say? Always. Again, I say rejoice. Dr. Barrick's commentary on Ecclesiastes is called Ecclesiastes the Philippians of the Old Testament. This is why. We can rejoice in the midst of the pleasure by enjoying and being joyful in it as a gift. Or we can rejoice in the midst of the vanity and frustration of all we have contemplated today. We can rejoice and be joyful in both. Derek Kidner says this contrast is between the satisfying spiritual gifts of God, wisdom and knowledge and joy, which only those who please him can desire or receive, and the frustrating business of amassing what cannot be kept, a business which is the chosen lot of those who reject him. The true vanity is never enjoying this life. As we will see in the next chapter, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh and a time to mourn and a time to dance. The preacher has spent much time in contemplation of things that made him want to cry. Even in this last verse, there's this paradox of joy and vanity, isn't there? Perhaps this is why the Hebrew text includes verse 1 of the next chapter as part of this unit. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. Heaven is the way we began back in verse 13 in chapter 1. The person who never enjoys but only toils and gathers and works and makes and buys will eventually give it away to somebody else. And in this case, they must give it away to the one who pleases God. I love that. In the prophets and Psalms, there are many scenes of the last day when the kings of the earth must come into God's presence and give him all they have as a gift to the Son of God. Your gates shall be open continually, Isaiah says, and day and night they shall not be shut, that the people may bring to you the wealth of the nations with their kings led in procession. And Revelation ends the very same way. God gives to those with ears to hear wisdom to enjoy his gifts now. This enjoyment itself is the gift of God. Therefore, surely the Westminster Catechism is on the right track. With this book, when it concludes that the meaning of life is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. The preacher says that you may do that not only in formal worship, but in all the things that you do. It's an incredibly earthy book. Do not be so spiritual that you are no earthly good. Enjoy life because it's a gift from God. Look at work redemptively, even if you hate it. And you will learn to see it through God's eyes. Enjoy your pleasures, but don't live for them. Enjoy the common things of life, eating and drinking and being with friends, living on God's green earth. There's nothing better, he says. There's nothing better. Do so now, today, because tomorrow you may no longer be here. And that would surely be a great vanity. Lord, I pray you would help us to understand these words of the book of Ecclesiastes and taken from the life of Solomon himself, who had such an incredible life. You gave him everything. And only after experimenting in all these things did he come to realize these truths, even though he was led with wisdom his whole life. I pray, Lord, that his conclusion in our passage here today, something that a lot of Christians are told they should never do. And here it is that we're told that this is one of the greatest gifts you can give us. Too many Christians are working and not enjoying and not smelling the roses while they're here. You give us this incredible planet, this unbelievable life that we have. You have fit everything and made it so perfect. And you've made it for us to enjoy, and we are sinful when we don't do that. And I would pray that you would help us to think about these common, mundane, secular pursuits that you give to your people, and you allow us to enjoy them because of what you have done for us. Pray that you would help this to be something that would stick deeply in our minds, especially when we have to go back into this world, into the work that we may not enjoy, the things that we might not enjoy on a regular daily basis, being participating in. But we can do that, and we can do it in the midst of great times or in the midst of the horrible times. This is something, Lord, I think people really need to hear and to grasp and to hold on to, and to see that it's okay to do that, because we're told so often in the church that this is not okay. And yet here we are reading it from Ecclesiastes itself. Help us to see the truth that the preacher gives us in the midst of the difficult things that this passage has us to contemplate, and the paradoxes and the irony that it's so full of. Thank you for the book, and thank you for being with us. We ask you hear our prayer in Christ's name.